Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to this week's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE Presents. This week on Revolution with High C, spring is here. And as we look forward to new growth, new life, new opportunities and surprises in the coming year, we also look back to the culture and ancient wisdom of Egypt. We travel down the Nile to the Egypt of ancient times and back again to today with our revolutionary guest this month, Dr. Paul Harrison. Enjoy our monthly astrology outlook with James Moran, plus our monthly segment, Living Well with Linda, offering you natural alternatives to staying healthy in body, mind, and spirit, presented by Linda Wiley. Stay tuned for our popular call-in segment to receive on-air readings. And, coming right up, join High C, Mildred Lynn, John, and Deb for this week's weekly roundtable discussion topic, Are You Healing or Creating?
And hello, everyone. Welcome to the show today. This is High C. Thank you for listening. Hopefully you found us at the right time, since we had to, at least in the United States, change our time overnight and move forward ahead, and you're not too tired, feeling as if you lost that crucial hour of sleep. I will remind you about some of the places that you can find us or contact us. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/fireflywillows. You can find us on the web at fireflywillows.com/live. You can email us if you would like to at info@fireflywillows.com. If you are interested in getting a reading on the air during the show today, then you can either Skype in from the show page or you can call in. And the phone number for that is 646-716-5510. You can also find out or contact me, High C, at tarotbyhighc.net, or you're welcome to email me with questions if you're interested in a reading at HIC@tarotbyhighc.net. So there you go. That's all of the places and ways that you can contact us. And we certainly would encourage you, if you have questions, if you'd like to continue the conversation about something, then visit our Facebook page, post there, and we're happy to continue talking about anything that comes up on any of our shows. I'm going to be joined today by our fellow co-hosts, Mildred Lynn McDonald and John and Deb Caracella, for our weekly round table. And I believe that Mildred, I know that we're in the middle of a Mercury retrograde, so John and Deb are making every attempt to get in, with Mercury retrograde causing a little bit of a challenge. But I believe that Mildred Lynn McDonald is here at this point.
I am here. Hi, Sue.
Welcome to the show. Thank you. Hopefully you're feeling better.
I am. And I think you can tell by my voice quality. I'm almost back to normal.
Excellent. Well, we know that even last month on my show, you weren't able to join us because you weren't feeling well for the round table. So we're glad that finally you seem to be on the mend.
Yeah. For our listeners out there, I had, in my opinion, the most lingering case of bronchitis I've ever had. So that's why I physically wasn't able to participate.
Well, hopefully that is behind you now and you can look forward to spring, to new health, and feeling better and get out in the sun a little bit, the warm weather, and that will just make all of this a distant memory.
I know. February is already gone. It never happened.
That's right. And it looks like John and Deb have also joined us. Welcome to the show, John and Deb.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry for the delay. We had a minor technical difficulty.
Well, that's all right. At least we know it's Mercury's fault. You know, what's a good Westerner if we can't find something outside of ourselves to blame for the problem? which actually leads into our roundtable just a little bit. So today there was a topic, and this was actually something that I was kind of inspired to talk about when I saw a video that was posted by a clairvoyant and healer named Sarah Entrup, And the title of both the video as well as a teleclass that she did was, Are You Healing or Creating Your Life? And that idea of healing versus creating was very intriguing to me, especially for people like all of us who work, well, in what might be considered the healing arts or a healing field, or we might often be called healers because of the kind of work that we do. But even beyond that, thinking of the idea of healing versus creating, I want to toss out a few questions or ideas to you to start thinking about, and then I'll give a little preamble so you can think of how you want to respond to these perhaps. But I would ask you, what do you feel is the difference between healing and creating, or healing cycles and creation cycles? And how do you recognize when you need to be in each, and when you might be denying or ignoring what you need to be in, or overdoing it at the expense of the other? So staying in a healing cycle when you need to now be in the creation cycle, or vice versa. How would you maybe see those two things as separate? What energetically, how do they feel different? How would you recommend acting differently within them? And how do you recognize where you are within that cycle so that it's easier to just be present with it and flow with it rather than feeling like it's getting in the way or holding you back? And one thing I was really thinking about is, in our culture, the healing part seems to be very ignored or dismissed. We don't want to put any emphasis on what is needed for healing. We're very much a creation kind of culture. It's about doing and making something happen and being out there and, you know, accomplishing everything on your bucket list before you die. And at the expense of healing, because often what we find is people don't acknowledge or honor the need for healing, and they just push through. So, for example, people get sick physically, and instead of honoring that in their body and saying, I need to take some downtime, I need to take some time off and just relax, just rest, just allow my body to regenerate itself and heal, we take medications to mask the symptoms. And we use phrases even like, I'm just going to push through, or I just need to get over this, or I'm not going to let this keep me down. And so we mask the symptom, and then we go into work. And even though we may not feel the symptoms because of the medication we've taken, that doesn't mean our body is actually healing. And what we're trying to create under those conditions is not going to be very effective. And we then will find that we keep trying to repeat or recreate the same things over and over, or we get stuck because either our body will shut down completely and suddenly 2 days later it's like we can't even get out of bed, or we find that we just keep creating the same thing over and over and wonder why things aren't changing or growing or evolving. But that's because we haven't actually done healing in order for something new to be able to be created or to come in. So those were the things that this kind of inspired in my head when I was looking at this and thinking about this. So now I will hand it over to you, dear co-hosts, and also to you, dear listeners, to ponder and think about and join the conversation at our Facebook page if you would like. What do you feel is the difference between healing and creating? How would you speak to someone who feels called to, say, a profession like healing? Because there's a difference between like being a healer versus a creator. A creator to me would be like a coach of some sort. And that's not really healing so much as that's helping to create something new and get something moving, versus healing may be a Reiki master who is helping facilitate the energetic process of healing the body so that then future creation can take place. But maybe the person would work with somebody else other than the Reiki master to start the creation process. So how do you see the difference between those two? How do you know when you're in each cycle? And how do you recommend honoring each of those cycles when we, so that we can stay in alignment and in flow with them?
Hi, see, I love this topic area. I think it's fabulous. And as you were talking, what came in for me is, because I have a feeling nature, healing involves a lot of breathing in space. And the creation involves, at least from my perspective, a lot of laughter. And the limbo or the transition stage, which so many people, including myself, may find uncomfortable, or you want to get on with this or you want to get on with that, I find that requires a lot of patience and a lot of asking yourself this question or commenting on what's going on in the context of, well, that's interesting. And that, of course, takes practice and discipline. And the other thing that came into me as you were speaking so eloquently on both the healing and creating is, oh, my heavens, I've just personally experienced the healing phase with the bronchitis that developed, that lingered on for a month, which was congestion, energetic congestion in my heart chakra and also in my throat chakra. So the fifth chakra and the fourth. And as you were talking, I was reflecting back on, well, where did I go energetically when that was happening? And what really came into me is that I was drawing on a structure that I had put in place for previous healings, and that helped guide me through the process. Because interestingly enough, even though my heart and my throat chakras felt very congested, I had an inner sense at my core that I was healthy. So I'd like to throw that out for anybody out there that's going through bronchitis or any other type of illness, and ask, in the healing stage, do you have an intrinsic sense at your core that you're healthy and you're able to identify where specifically the energy is congested or whatever, or do you feel that it's a big blob of unhealthiness or misalignment? So they're my initial thoughts.
For me, I kind of grappled with this because I don't see myself on either side of the fence. I see myself on the fence. I don't consider myself a healer, and I don't consider myself a creative facilitator. I think of myself as just a space. I hold space well, and I sit in the middle very easily. So I don't know that I've got a lot to say that would be helpful on either side of that.
Well, when you're feeling under the weather or ill, do you tend to try to just push through and keep getting things done, or are you willing to just stop and not feel guilty for not getting things done because you know you need to let your body just rest and heal?
I have always been very fortunate to have the time and the ability to allow myself to just stop. I have never had the pressure that many other people have to live with, where you really don't feel that you have the choice to stop. And I have always had that choice. So I have always been a individual that says, you know what, that I just don't have it with me right now. I don't have the energy. I don't have the ability. I'm just going to sit here for a little while and I'll do the minimum that I can, but I'm not pushing it.
So for you or for John or Mildred, for people that, you know, maybe don't have the ability to be able to just stop like that because they think they can't take the time off of work or whatever, what would you suggest to at least support the healing process, even if they have to still be doing some things that might not let them completely stop and rest the way they need to?
Well, I guess I would say that as trite as this sounds, stop in between your breaths, right? Stop in the moment where you just, you know, breathe. And when you know, I was thinking about this, the healing versus creating thing. I think when you're doing healing, it's the yin that leads And when you're doing creating, it's the yang that leads. Not to say that they're exclusively one or the other, because they're not. But if you think about the healing process, and in the video that you sent around to help us prep, that was the discussion about healing was about tearing things down, right? You know, we often think of healing as repairing things, but what I found very profound in was it Lisa or Sarah?
Sarah.
In her presentation was, she talked about the destruction. She talked about the letting go as part of the healing process. And I think that's actually a very complicated and very powerful thing to contemplate, that healing isn't always about repairing. It's about destroying or deconstructing. And even as we in this Western culture decide that we're going to stop doing and start and allow ourselves to heal, even in our healing process, we think we need to be doing something. And, you know, so we kind of even subvert our energies around healing by saying, well, I've got to heal myself. And sometimes, I think as Mildred Lynn hinted at, there's congestion that needs to be removed as opposed to something that needs to be fixed. There's something that needs to be disposed of, and that is, I think it's a subtle difference, and one that we in the West often don't want to do, because we're an acquisitive culture. We have an acquisitive style, which is we want more, not less. And so it just struck me that there's a process of creative destruction, or not even creative destruction, of just destructive destruction to cleanse the space, to empty the space in order to create room for creation. And I don't know that we do that very well in the West. I think we're always trying to fix what's there instead of clearing out what's there to make room for something else.
Well, and it makes me think, I was talking to somebody about this, even with the way we approach medicines, using Western medicine versus like an alternative or herbal medicines or alternative approaches. With Western medicines, we've become conditioned to seeing results almost immediately. So, you know, if I'm congested, I want to take a pill and within an hour, I want to be able to breathe and feel like I'm not congested anymore. That's not really healing, but it makes us feel better. And so we think that we're better. Whereas if you're using more natural alternative approaches like herbal approaches, herbs are more gentle and work with the body, and they take time. So you won't necessarily feel that immediate relief in an hour. But if you're consistent with them, especially during the acute phase, for example, if you're consistent with them within 24 to 48 hours, not only will you start to feel better, you're also able to keep it from getting worse. And it's working with your body to increase your immune system so that you are less likely or prone to get sick like that again. Whereas our Western medicines deal with it in the moment, but then we often are more likely to get it again, and oftentimes it'll then be worse because we haven't allowed our immune system to build up its resistance to what that was in the first place through the natural healing process.
Yeah, it's almost like we short-circuit the part of the curve where you have to let go of something and just want to get the curve back above the line so that we're back in the game again. And I don't think that works very well.
Well, healing is about having to sit with something and be present with it and allow whatever it is that you feel to come up in order to work through it. Whereas what we often do is I want to deny it. So I want to mask it, pretend like I'm not sick, keep doing things, and then I can convince myself that somehow I've gotten better when really I haven't. And that speaks even on a deeper level, like emotionally. People don't want to sit with their emotional pain in order to heal it. They want to do something, use something, avoid something in order to not have to go there.
Yeah, so they want to make it go away.
Mm-hmm. Well, so they keep doing. So they think they're creating, but, well, if I just keep working, if I just focus on work, then I don't have to feel the grief, you know, and then I'll get over it. And that's not really what healing is about.
Right.
Yeah, the other thing, too, Heisey, that I've noticed, and I've noticed with myself, and this speaks to when you were saying you're trying to force yourself to get well or push yourself through it, which is exactly what I, in my head, experienced over the last month, but my body had another idea. So I'd offer for listeners to look at what is really necessary to be done. As Deb was saying, she has the luxury of being able to give her body time, but I'd also like to give Deb a lot of credit because I feel it's also her belief system and a mindset and a heart set that recognizes that her body needs time to heal. And look at what needs to be done and what you think needs to be done. And if you really are honest with yourself, I believe that you will find that there is space to heal.
And so, you know, Mildred, I just want to piggyback there. And if there isn't space to heal, chances are your life is too crowded and you got to let some things go.
Yeah, because what I noticed with myself, and this is kind of comical. I noticed I missed two internet radio shows, and Deb and John and High C were kind enough to put a special show together for me, which I was very appreciative of. But I observed my reaction. So I was putting myself under a lot of unnecessary pressure, and how it manifested was, oh my heavens, I'm mortified that I'm not able to show up for the team. And when I look back at it and reflect on my reaction, and I'm sure a lot of people have their own version of this when they're trying to force themselves through an illness or some form of healing situation, when I look back at it, I see all this energy that I directed towards feeling mortified was really not in alignment with my highest purpose. So it was a great learning for me, and obviously something I needed to do on my healing path. So now taking that, I'll sit with it, and then how can I turn this dismantling into something that's creative? And I'm looking forward to the next opportunity, not to experience bronchitis or be ill, but of course along everybody's path, that's going to happen because we're human beings on the earth, hoping that I might be able to say, this is interesting, and let it be. And I've learned that from High C.
Well, with those words of wisdom, certainly when you've learned something from me, those are words of wisdom. But I think that what you've just said is a great thing for people to really start thinking about and see how they can start applying that. And so we will use that as a point of stopping the conversation here, but hopefully if people would like to offer their suggestions or have questions or continue the conversation, feel free to jump over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/fireflywillows. And with that, we will bring this roundtable discussion to a close and hopefully continue it online because there's a lot more to hear, to delve into, to unpack, as it were, with this topic. So thank you very much, Mildred, John, and Deb, for what you've had to offer and contribute to the conversation and for being here today.
Well, thanks a lot, I see.
Thanks. Yeah, have a good day.
Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your weekend. So for those listening, stay tuned. Coming up, we're going to have our monthly astrology update, as well as our Living Well with Linda segment, which offers you alternative methods to staying healthy in body, mind, and spirit with Linda Wiley. And following that is going to be my conversation with our revolutionary guest this week, which is self-described profane Egyptologist, Dr. Paul Harrison. So that will be extremely interesting, and I'm very excited about that. And later in the show, we'll have our magical moment, and you'll also have a chance to call in and get a reading live on the air. And I'll just remind you, if you want that, you can Skype in from the show page, or you can call in at 646-716-5510. So keep listening, stay tuned, and enjoy the rest of today's show.
Is your heart a beacon filled with purpose, leading you forth on your path in passion and spirit, helping you live a life of wonder and joy? Join visionary artist Annette Wagner for an afternoon of intentional creativity, unearthing purpose and passion in your life in Garden of My Heart, Visioning Your Life. What is your calling? How will you take your work out into the world? Through this workshop, we engage our right and left brain and fully invest our dreams with intention. And our vision plan begins to manifest those dreams immediately in subtle and amazing ways. You'll be surprised. Create a business plan from the heart. Join Annette Wagner for Garden of My Heart, Visioning Your Life, on Saturday, March 23rd from 10 to 5 in Mountain View, California. Register today at AnnetteWagnerArt.com under workshops. Your heart will thank you.
Hello, dear listeners. This is James Moran with your astrology update for the month of March 2013. Very exciting month coming up with the vernal equinox on the 20th. The vernal equinox is the time when day and night are exactly equal. There is no tilt of the earth in relation to the sun on that day. So day and night are equal. And from that point forward, the balance begins to tip towards day. So day grows longer from that day on. And symbolically, the balance is tipped towards light, towards life. It's the time of spring. It's the time of the fertile fields. The seeds are beginning to sprout. The harvest is beginning to grow. And many cultures build their new year around this, or around the full moon that comes after this. Jewish Passover, the Persian New Year, Easter, which is actually a combination of cultures. That's why you see bunnies and eggs mixed with the story of Christ on Easter. The bunnies and eggs is more from a pagan European tradition. And Easter itself is named after the goddess Easter, which I believe is a Germanic, possibly fertility goddess. The egg hunt, some think it had some significance that the egg hunt was actually a hunt for eggs in fields in agricultural lands, just as a symbol for fertility in the fields for auspicious harvest. So that's our vernal equinox. And exactly on the vernal equinox, speaking of fertility, we have both Mars and Venus and the Sun and the Moon are conjoined with the Uranus-Pluto T-square in the sky. So I'll explain all of that. Sounds very complicated. But I'll begin by saying that Mars and Venus and the Sun and the Moon happen to be the planets in the sky that tend to symbolize the energies of the male, the female, masculine, feminine, yin, yang. Mars and Venus are even the symbols for male and female. Mars is a symbol for male, and Venus, the glyphs that are used to represent the planets, are the symbol of male and female. And to some extent, you could say the same of the sun and the moon, symbol of the moon, the symbol of the sun. So they're joining the Uranus-Pluto T-square. So Uranus is the archetype of the unexpected, the sudden. Pluto is the archetype of the deep compulsion. So if Mars is the principle of activity, activation, bravery, assertiveness, anger, and Venus is the archetype of beauty, the law of attraction, pleasure, art, vanity, and if just in those two together we get, well, for one we get sex, Mars being the assertive, the active, Venus being the attractive principle, the principle of pleasure. We also get artistic forms, art forms that are active, like dancing, when those two can join in the sky. It's a great time to go out dancing. And so those two can join in the sky right on the Uranus-Pluto square. The Uranus-Pluto square means those two planets are 90 degrees from each other. When Venus and Mars can join right on top of Uranus, it means that they're square to Pluto. They're 90 degrees from Pluto. Pulls them all together in a combination that makes for sudden, you know, on its challenging end, it can be sudden anger because Mars is involved. On its kind of more realized end, it can be sudden bravery or sudden assertiveness in love because Venus is there. The sudden unexpected love and the sudden impulse for acting on love. With the sun and the moon also there, it's an amazing combination in the sky. The sun and the moon will also be there. When the sun and the moon are there, it tends to take the Uranus-Pluto T-square, that revolutionary energy, that unexpected liberating energy of Uranus that's compelled and driven by Pluto that we've seen ever since that square began in the sky back around 2008. We've seen in the Arab Spring, we've seen in the Occupy movement and various kind of manifestations out in the world at large. But when the sun and the moon come in there, it tends to make that principle of Uranus and Pluto, that revolutionary, compelling principle towards transformation, very personal to us, since the sun and the moon are the most personal planets in the sky, the moon being the emotions and the emotional body, the sun being the will and the kind of conscious sense of identity. So it makes it very personal. And to find out how personal, can look at that combination and where it lands in your particular birth chart. If you'd like help with that, I can be reached at james@jamesmoran.co. That's james@jamesmoran.co. My website is jamesmoran.co. And so this whole combination is probably going to see its very exciting, you could say, culmination on the 26th of March. We have a full moon right on that Uranus T-square, right with Venus, Mars, the sun, the moon, because it's a full moon. They're all there together. So very exciting month ahead. And I hope you get to enjoy it and learn so much about yourself. Thank you.
Firefly Willows, LIVE, is proud to support Hidden Villa, a nonprofit educational organization whose mission is to inspire a just and sustainable future through their programs, land, and legacy. Hidden Villa stretches over 1,600 acres of open space in Los Altos Hills, California, about 40 miles south of San Francisco. Purchased in 1924 by the Duvenick family, who established a nonprofit trust in 1960 that continues to today. Hidden Villa provides summer camps, school programs for pre-K through 12th grade, public programs, sustainable agriculture, volunteer opportunities, and internships to the community. Discover things to do at Hidden Villa and how to donate at www.hiddenvilla.org. This tip of the week from Hidden Villa's Environmental Education Program. When you see a bird, it's easy to fixate on what it looks like and dive immediately into a field guide. An equally rewarding way of bird watching is to observe what the bird is doing. Is it sitting on a wire and pumping its tail, or hanging upside down under oak leaves? Interpreting a bird's behavior can introduce you to a richer understanding than just simple identification.
Welcome to Living Well with Linda, presented by Linda Wiley. Linda Wiley is a certified chef, food therapist, Reiki master, and student of the healing arts. Linda has dabbled in many areas of life, giving her the wisdom and experience that allows her to offer healing perspectives as we face life's challenges. She has had a restaurant, a catering company, created beautiful delis, and done healing work around and with food for the past 25 years. She has always had and continues to cultivate in Eugene, Oregon, where she currently resides, an organic garden with medicinal and savory herbs, edible flowers, and all manner of fruits and vegetables. Linda enlivens the body, mind, and soul through her focus and use of local, seasonal, and organic food. So please enjoy this episode of Living Well with Linda, offered to you by Linda Wiley.
Hello and welcome. Linda Wiley here with Living Well with Linda, your monthly guide to the well-being of your body, mind, and spirit. It's really about an alternative approach to life, healing, and living well within our changing world. There's a quote by Hippocrates that I especially like, and it'll kind of be the flavor, the underlying thread or theme that runs through our monthly chat. He says, "Let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food." I also say the same thing. So today I would like to chat a bit about what something I call food philosophy. Since we are in between the seasons, I thought this was a good time to get us energized for the coming year with perhaps some new understanding of food and life and how it all connects. Though spring is in the air, for most of us, it's still cold and all the winter truths still like to be honored and applied. Like being cozy by the fire, reading, resting as much as possible, and using our warming herbs and spices, like curries and ginger, garlic, onions, cinnamon, and cloves. A baked winter squash covered in curry sauce is delicious and warming and comforting, served with steamed greens, onions, and garlic, and quinoa. It's a yummy meal. All food has different energetic qualities. Some are warming, some are cooling, drying, moistening, bitter, sweet, and salty. The best meals incorporate all the flavors in an artful and creative way. Understanding the energetics of food can also facilitate a deeper healing. It's about balance and keeping all the parts of the engine running smoothly. In each season, we eat differently because nature offers us what is needed for our body in each season. So if we follow the season, there really is no guessing anymore. Nature provides. As we learn to see this way, it's fun to honor life and eat within the limited but real range with the real types of food that are available to us seasonally. For instance, in winter, we do not eat tomatoes unless they grow in our local area. In winter, we eat the food that we put up during our summer growing season, or else what we can get that is as local as possible, what is perhaps in our greenhouse or covered rows or root cellars. Some veggies actually winter over well, and it's a really fun, creative project to create a winter garden. Heck, you know, in the old days, you did not most likely have fresh red bell peppers and tomatoes for dinner. And why would you? Those are foods to eat in the middle of summer, not the middle of winter. So you see, Mother Nature really does offer all we need in each season to sustain us. We just need to remember that wisdom, pay attention to it, and apply it. As with all of life, it's in the application. I have been a student of the art of life, of cooking and food for many years. I have dived deep looking into what is the truth of food. It seems that everything is energy and vibration, so that would mean everything. Everything, like rocks, trees, computers, clouds, cars, and on it goes. Plants, veggies, fruits, all vibration, light, and energy. What do we think of as spirit? Energy, vibration, the play of dark and light. And let us not forget us and our beautiful molecular vehicles that we call the body. Yes, we are also this pervasive energy and vibration and light. So it is when we partake of food that it is really way past proteins, carbohydrates, and fats. It is about taking in that essence of life, which is light and vibration, and feeding our bodies with that. This is what the body needs to function at its best, most optimum. And that looks like clean, organic, local, seasonal foods. These types of food heal and keep the body open and connected to the earth and all of life. Honoring the seasonality of life is something that has often been glossed over in today's busy world. Yet our bodies go through the changes, as the earth does, whether or not we know it. And how could it not? For we are the earth, and the earth is us. When we eat clean, good food, our bodies and minds function as they should, and the channels between heart and mind stay open, and we grow and learn, and there is a clarity within. When we eat processed, unconscious, unhealthy foods filled with GMOs, preservatives, additives, artificial flavors and colors, we disrupt the electromagnetic workings of the body, and it keeps consciousness at bay. And we are more apt to fall asleep, become unconscious followers of the program, sick, unhealthy, unable to care for ourselves, not able to think right or connect the dots, disconnected from the earth. Not a pretty picture, but it is a realistic one, and sadly so. I realize that's a mouthful, but there is no denying food makes a huge difference and has a huge impact upon our bodies and minds. Because the other part of the truth about food is that eating is actually the act of taking spirit and putting it into our bodies. This is what nourishes and gives life and health. This is why food is so important. Food that is simple, straightforward, raw as much as possible, lightly steamed or cooked to retain all the colors of life and the life force vitality, electromagnetically enlivening the brain and body, and eaten simply in appreciation. Yes, this is the understanding. This helps take away the food issues of our time, as it puts us forward into right relationship with ourselves, our surroundings, the seasons, the local energy, the local food. This is a critical understanding for food freedom, and food freedom is front and center. Growing our own food ensures the best that we can get. As we become aware of the toxicity of most modern food and take back our responsibility for our health and well-being of body, mind, and soul, we will find and feel many great rewards. One will be that we are consciously no longer supporting all that is life-threatening. As we step forward in non-compliance, with a deeper understanding that makes us want to do so, we start to change the world. Yet we must relearn how to live off the land again and be in harmony with our environment. It's hard work. Yes, it is. We have become lazy and sleepy to what is really going on around us and what has happened to our world in the meantime. But times, they are changing. The veil is thin. And for those with courage, it's easy to pierce. This understanding of life and food and clean water is so important. It's critical to our well-being and crucial for all of life. This is all part of our way forward out of the mess we find ourselves within by remembering what matters most. If white man had followed native ways, there would be clean air, food, and water for all. I think it's time to rethink things, and deeply so, and that time would be now. As spring comes closer, we can look forward to sprouts and tender greens being added back into the diet, and lots of them. Start now. Spring is a time of liver and cleansing, and liver loves green food. It's a good idea to think of doing a liver flush, perhaps a round of colonic, simple fasting for a day or a few days, making green juices, adding greens to our juice combos. We will speak more of this next time. But for now, as we look around, see that the earth is starting to come alive again, to awaken from her slumber and rest, and to see that now the time of rejuvenation begins. The tender little sprouts push upward through the soil to the sun. We want to partake of their vibrance and strength to get life going again, for as our own self to sprout forward out of our slumber once again and be rejuvenated. As within, so without. Try to feel the connection within and honor the new possibilities of life sprouting forth and stirring once again. These tender little sprouts need love and care and attention. As within, so without. And so it is, another cycle begins. Until next time, be well, take care, and do enjoy. My recommendation of the month. For those more interested in finding out about GMOs and food freedom, check out these DVDs, easily found on Amazon.com or Netflix. Genetic Roulette, Food Inc., and Food Matters. Thank you for joining me today for this segment of Living Well with Linda. I'm Linda Wiley. If you would like to chat further with questions, comments, or consultations, I welcome that. Please contact me at linda@prestia, P-R-E-S like Sam, T like Tom, IA.com.
Travel down the Nile to the Egypt of ancient times and back again with our revolutionary guest today. Dr. Paul Harrison obtained his PhD in Egyptian archaeology from University College London in 2012. In addition to 10 years of public speaking, lecturing, and teaching, Paul has been a music performance consultant, television host, and shot pilots for Sci-Fi and Sky Television. He was recently interviewed on the Arts Council's Resonance FM show, Panel Borders, on the role of Egypt in popular culture. Paul is currently shooting the documentary Eye on the Needle, an exploration of the history and condition of the Egyptian obelisk called Cleopatra's Needle. His book, Profane Egyptologists, is an examination of the boundaries of Egyptology, and it's being drafted for publication in 2013. So please join the revolution in welcoming to the show today, Dr. Paul Harrison. And welcome to the show, Dr. Paul Harrison.
Hi. That's quite an applause there. Wasn't expecting that.
I had to bus people in. I mean, it was amazing. We ran out of parking, had to do all sorts of things just to get all those people here to hear you.
It's like the canned laughter from Friends, right?
Yes. Now you're joining us from London, so hopefully the weather is there nice and not too unpleasant as it can sometimes be on occasion.
It's been snowing on and off.
Really?
Sorry to say. Yeah.
Well, then I won't.
Some people
tell
would say that's nice.
Those are some people, and we won't talk about those kind of people.
No, I don't think we should.
And I will neglect to mention that it's probably around 70 here.
Excellent. Yeah.
Well, I try. So the first thing actually that I would like to ask you is. Both your book title as well as your blog, you call yourself the profane Egyptologist.
Ah, that's actually, I should probably clarify that. I don't call myself the profane Egyptologist. That's really the subject matter of the work. Essentially, profane Egyptologist is a title that, it's actually a term I came across whilst reading the works of Michael Aquino. As you're probably familiar, he was the leader or the establisher of the Temple of Set, which was, I'm really painting myself in a good light from my reading sources here, aren't I? Right from the outset. I was reading some works on Satanism. And I was doing some research on Egyptian-themed cults, the esoteric, the occult, when I was starting the PhD. And I was reading this one particular tract, this Book of Set, because it kind of seemed to fit all of those criteria. And he had this term, profane Egyptologist. And I found this term really interesting because what it does is it highlights a perceived division between what Egyptologists are doing and what his group are doing. Okay, so it kind of highlights that ideological difference right there. I picked up on that because I thought, well, this is interesting. This tells us something about how we, the establishment, are being perceived, for one thing. And this seems like something that needs to be addressed or explored. So that's where that comes from. I'm not the profane Egyptologist, although I'm probably going to be called that a few times in my career. But, so that's where that comes from.
Oh, I thought maybe you were just known for cussing up a storm when you're on a gig or something.
Depends.
I will just touch on something you said there, because there is a big misconception, and especially around what you were just mentioning, that let us just remind people that the Temple of Set and people that are perhaps interested in Set, one of the gods from Egypt, has nothing to do with Satanism.
That's probably a point that I should clarify as well. The Temple of Set itself obviously sprang out of the works of Anton LaVey and the Church of Satan. Now, the Church of Satan wasn't necessarily what we would depict as the Satanism that we see in horror movies or what have you. It was a movement that seemed to focus on the intellectual divergence from, should we call it, mainstream currents of fundamentalist Christian America at the time. And as that kind of broke down, as schisms were formed, the Temple of Set came out of that. And I think that how do you pronounce that anyway?
Let us not worry about that.
Let's not worry about that for now. He turned to Set, and in an episode that's very reminiscent of Aleister Crowley's dictation of the Book of the Law, back in Cairo in the very kind of the turn of the 19th century. He explains a visit from Set, and it wasn't a literal visit from Set, but he says he felt Set come into his presence and decided to dictate these words down onto paper to establish this Book of Set. And from what I've seen, I mean, I've had very limited interaction with the Temple of Set. I have to say they were not one of the groups that I focused on in my study, because they fit very different criteria to Kemetic Reconstruction and Eclectic Paganism, which is what I ended up focusing most of my work on. And, so just to get back to the point about that, they're kind of an intellectual movement, and Set, or even Satan, was seen as a symbol of rebellion against these kind of normative models of American culture. Not necessarily the worship of, not supposed to be the worship of evil or you know, any of those kind of litigious concepts. So,
and that's also kind of a, it's not a true representation of how the ancient Egyptians viewed Set.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, Set was only really demonized after the, it was kind of the New Kingdom, the rise of the certain interpretations of the Osiris myth. And of course, the Osiris myth goes back to the pyramid texts. But Set was seen as, you know, a potentially beneficial figure, a defender of Ra on the sunboat, who, of course, Ra being the creator, was responsible for order. And Set was also responsible for fighting off Apep, you know, the serpent of darkness. So even though Set was said to have carried qualities that were not necessarily
pleasant,
the ideal Egyptian type, and there's an interesting reference to that in the Ramesside dream book about the Sethian archetype, and the ideal Egyptian ideal archetype, which is more based on the principles of Horus or Heru. Set was worshipped. He had you know, very acceptable cult centers, and we don't use cult in the same way that we use that terminology nowadays. It doesn't have the negative connotations that it carries nowadays. When we say a center of cult worship, we literally just mean a religious center for that god's activities and for that god's followers. And of course, we have to remember that these were not necessarily in the Old Kingdom spontaneous groups of individuals. Maybe we should get into this at some point. From any class, kind of worshipping willy-nilly, these were state-sanctioned, arguably. The larger temples were all state-sanctioned. So Set was very much a part of the natural order, even though he was seen as the other, the exception to natural order. He represented the desert, Deshret, redness, non-fertility in the growth sense.
But I think there he represents a very integral part to Ma'at, which is that idea, that principle that the ideal Egyptian would strive for, and everyone wanted to live in Ma'at, as well as Ma'at being a goddess, of course. Mm-hmm. But Set, just like with being in the boat of Ra, plays the integral part of chaos and anarchy and disorder, which is needed to stir things up in order for things to change and grow and evolve, because if they stayed in Ma'at all the time, they would stagnate.
Absolutely. And I mean, it kind of comes back to what your guests were talking about on the previous section, that there needs to be a certain amount of destruction in any society, in any system, be that macro or micro, you know, large scale or small scale, for things to progress, for things to move forward. So, yeah, a very necessary part of nature, but unfortunately demonized, you know, when later periods came along. And then, of course, the Greco-Romans brought their interpretations, their very misguided interpretations, to Egyptian religion and Egyptian spirituality, and that's what informed a lot of our earliest Egyptologists, who of course weren't trained as Egyptologists, they were classicists.
Right. Well, and they also came from a very heavily Judeo-Christian cultural influence. You see that, I think, in a lot of the early, I mean, if you just look at like translations from Budge,
mm-hmm.
Certainly we have a lot to be grateful for Budge in terms of what he did and brought a lot of stuff forward and that kind of thing. But you see that Judeo-Christian influence come in, even in the terminology he uses and the way he says things in the translations, which hopefully today we're starting to see a little bit of a shift away from that.
Budge is a fairly dirty word in Egyptology, if I'm honest with you.
He's profane, perhaps.
He was an interesting character, and he had an interesting social world. I mean, we kind of forget, we need to think of the context of these people were working in. And as far as I'm aware, Florence Farr, who was, of course, part of the Order of the Golden Dawn, and arguably brought a lot of the Egyptian influence. She published a book on Egyptian magic very early, and brought a lot of the Egyptian influence into the Golden Dawn, which potentially exposed Crowley to those things. Mm-hmm. Now, she was doing research at the British Museum around the time that Budge was working there, which makes you wonder, you know, if there was any contact, how different those hierarchies were back then. I mean, we think about a kind of sanctioned, quote-unquote, form of Egyptology being done by positivistic, institutionalized academics. And then we think of there being kind of a binary opposition with another camp of alternative mavericks. Now, both of these ideas are arguably very contentious. You know, there's actually the reality of any situation like that is once you start picking apart the stereotypes, what we see is a range, what we see is a continuum of people doing practices. You know, we see people doing research one way and people doing research another way, and never the twain shall meet necessarily when it comes to alternative archaeology and archaeology. But that's got a historical precedent. Sorry, should I have not stopped talking there?
No, that's okay. So, thinking back to earlier times, what actually attracted or drew you towards Egypt and Egyptology in the first place?
It's a mixture of things, and I won't bore you with excessive detail, but it's something that we study over here at in primary school. So that's kind of age 7 or so. As a subject, it really, really kind of took my interest. But that may have just been the teacher. It may have just been that it was one of the teachers that I liked, and that was that. But the subject itself and going to the British Museum, and we're kind of culturally indoctrinated isn't the right term, but we're culturally familiar with Egypt in the West through a bizarre set of kind of historical associations because of our involvement in Egypt after the defeat of Napoleon. We've always viewed Egypt as part of the British Empire, and even after it was annexed from that empire, and it's, you know, obviously a very different situation now, there's still this sense of, in the West, this sense of heritage or cultural familiarity with Egypt, and I think that does resonate with a lot of people, be they in the West, wherever in the West, you know, be that in Europe or America.
And how early on did you then feel like you wanted to pursue that as an actual course of study?
As a course of study? Well, I do remember my folks buying me some books on ancient history and artifacts when I was a kid, and getting kind of quite into the treasure hunting idea. And I think it's fair to say I probably overdosed on Indiana Jones. And pop culture plays a really interesting role in people's construction of people's identity. And that's one of the things that I've kind of looked at in my research over the years, how these seemingly trivial things can actually be formative when we're quite young.
And I'm curious, the first time that you went to Egypt, I'm going to assume you've been to Egypt.
You been? Yes.
So the first time that you went to Egypt, what was that experience like? I mean, I have talked to a number of people, and people have very different experiences. Was it very academic for you? A lot of times people have this sensation of they feel like they've come home, or they suddenly just burst into tears. Even I think that the Egyptian people, they welcome you by saying welcome home when you come there. Mm. So I'm just, what was it like, what was that experience or resonance or whatever for you the first time that you actually stepped foot on Egyptian soil?
On Egyptian soil, yeah.
Sand, we should say, Egyptian sand.
not desert everywhere. For me, it was before I was an academic. I was still in my teens, actually, I think, or barely out of them the first time I went to Egypt. And I must admit, because I was so fascinated by the culture, by their rich kind of artistic heritage and their spiritual lineage and the kind of images of the gods and all of these things, it did feel like I was going to this exotic, mysterious, kind of exciting place where you're kind of moving from one set of ideologies, i.e. the Western set of ideologies, into a completely different world. That is at least the feeling of it. And there are a few things that reinforce that, of course, and that's one of those things being the tremendous culture shock of coming into modern Cairo. So there was definitely a romanticized notion of Egypt for me that was, I would say in some ways it was kind of quite quickly shattered. In other ways it was supported. There's a great dichotomy with people who go to Egypt expecting one thing and then feeling like they have to, shall we say, contend with modern Egypt to get to the quote-unquote good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay? And this is that was something I really wanted to explore in my work, because it seemed to me that that was fairly dismissive of the modern culture, and that in itself is quite telling of the way that we have categorized Egypt chronologically and geographically over the years, so that it excludes modern Arabic Egypt, or even anything after the 7th century, or even anything, you know, up after the Roman period, or even, strictly speaking, via Egyptology, anything past what we call the Greco-Roman period. So I found it really interesting to go over there and see what modern Egypt was like and kind of compare that with my responses to the ancient Egypt. And I found both cultures were very interesting. Obviously, the ancient culture resonated more with me just due to my own expectations, I suppose. But it's still anthropologically speaking, or, you know, just from a traveler's perspective, a really interesting place to go, just because you're faced with so many things you don't necessarily have to think about before you go, like the difference between, you know, hearing the mosques and the very practical differences of travel, how you negotiate modern Egypt if you're not driving at the time. It's a world of stimuli, different new stimuli. And going into the temples feels like a temporary, I don't want to say reprieve, because that seems like I'm painting modern Egypt in a negative sense, which I'm not trying to do. But going into the temples, it's like you're entering a very different space.
Well, and I would anticipate that that's what the ancient Egyptians felt going into those spaces. And for modern day, it's kind of like how somebody feels, say, when they walk in a cathedral. And you suddenly just feel that sense of hush. And that you're in sacred space, even though, you know, you walk into Notre Dame in Paris, and suddenly it's like you kind of forget that the hustle and bustle of Paris is right outside. Because
yeah, except, you know, I mean, you still do have that hustle and bustle in some areas. Certainly within the temples themselves, you're dealing with other tourists.
Well, yes. but I was thinking in terms of how ancient Egyptians may have felt going in. To the temple.
I do see the parallel, but I think it's fair to say that they conceptions of that space, you know, they have changed so much. There is still a resonance of ancient Egypt in there somewhere, but I think that a lot of that reverence that we anticipate is what we take in with us. You know, we only take to something what our own expectations, and it may exceed those or it may fall short of them. But when you go into an ancient temple, for instance, the first time I went into a pyramid on the Giza Plateau, I've stepped off of the bus at Giza and suddenly been assailed with Egyptian salesmen. Now, I wasn't used to this at the time, and I found it, you know, very intrusive and a little disturbing. And I quickly made my way towards the pyramid, paid my entrance ticket, and I managed to miss both ends of the tour. And I had this just kind of this really special moment for me, I guess, that I ended up in the bottom of this pyramid, looking at the King's Chamber, quote unquote King's Chamber, and with absolutely no one else there, no guides, no tour groups, no nothing. Now that, for me, met the expectations of, you know, what my childhood self wanted to see when I went to Egypt and looked at a temple or a pyramid or whatever. Most of the other sites I went to were very busy. There was the exception of Philae, which was very tranquil. But, you know, the conception of those spaces, their function has changed, one might argue, irrevocably. And it's kind of important to accept that and to realize that actually these things aren't there just for us to enjoy in a voyeuristic aesthetic sense anymore. Their function, if anything, in addition to our kind of our continued learning from them, is actually one of commerce. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you really have to wonder what exercise you're really partaking in when you go to visit these sites. And I accept that, you know, there are many groups who still go out to Egypt to practice their own forms of reconstructed spirituality. And, hey, you know, that's all good. That's fine. But there is now a competition for that space. And you'll find that that competition is with tourists and, you know, the economic industry, so to speak. So it's a very different situation what we have there now. And I think that's probably, coming back to your question, the first thing that struck me was the Egypt that we imagine is not there now. We can reconstruct the essence of it, quote unquote, whatever that may be. But geographically speaking, it's Egypt is a concept and a construct as much as it is anything else nowadays.
So mentioning your work, and that really ties into what you were just talking about, your thesis focused on Kemetic Reconstructionism and basically the revival and practice in modern day of Kemeticism, the spirituality and magic of ancient Egypt.
That's right.
Can you speak a bit to what drew you to that, and then also really some of the highlights of what it is that you discovered in putting that thesis together?
Absolutely, yeah. What drew me to it was, I had some firsthand experience with a range of Kemetic practices and eclectic pagan practices growing up, and I had kind of ex-girlfriends who were involved in paganism, so I'd experienced that firsthand. And on the Kemetic front, now, Kemetic obviously is one of these terms that's now an area of contention. It's a contested term, because on the one hand you have Kemetic used, well, there are kind of a few ways that it's used. The first is within Egyptology. And within Egyptology, of course, Kemet refers to the black land of Egypt, their self-description. So we're looking at the hieroglyphic sense that Egyptians described their own place. Yeah. The second use of that is in this instance, is the Kemetic community of Reconstructionists, who are using that term to disassociate the reconstructed Egypt with the thing I was just talking about, the modern Egypt, which is arguably a very different place, or not. I mean, it's easy to get into very litigious arguments there. But the third use of that particular terminology is for the Afrocentrist, Nile Valley Afrocentrist. And Kemetic black land literally becomes black land, i.e. Egypt as a land of black, as we understand the term in modern kind of usage. So it being the heritage of displaced African American communities. So because I'd come across all of these uses of the term, it made me really interested in seeing, you know, what were the debates around this? Why was Egypt in particular an area of contestation? Like, what's the appeal? Why Egypt in particular? Because it really does come back to this cultural conditioning. You know, we have this fascination for Egypt, but why? Why does it speak to us? Why do its gods speak to various people who aren't from Egypt? You know, why? What is it that survives? What is it that endures? And there are a number of kind of theories about that. You can go back to the ideas of Carl Jung. You can go back to the ideas of archetypes. And even in Egyptology, that's kind of been approached and looked at to a limited degree. So studying the Kemetic community for me was a matter of, I would say, disentangling all of these notions and trying to understand, you know, what was going on in each specific instance. Because we can't generalize when we approach these different groups who are using ancient cultures, because as soon as you start generalizing, that's when you've got this very, what we would call, a reductionist stance, homogenizing. You end up painting everything with broad strokes. One thing is acceptable, another is not. You know, Egyptology is acceptable, this other is not. And that was problematic for me, because I knew from my own experiences that, for one thing, Egyptology represents a whole range of responses to Egypt, and it's nowhere near as, the history of Egyptology is nowhere near as conservative or scientific or positivist as the alternatives accuse us of being. I say us. I'm counting myself as an Egyptologist in that instance. But of course, the range of practices that were happening outside of Egyptology were nowhere near as necessarily as polemic, as problematic as Egyptologists and the kind of more conservative Egyptologists might have painted them to be. So knowing that this range existed made me want to kind of figure out, well, what is happening here? Is it just this kind of pagan eclecticism that conservative Egyptologists really do seem to think is all that's going on? Is it just these really kind of problematic maverick ideas and, you know, that spring out of von Daniken? Or is it something else? Is there somewhere where we have a common ground, a shared language? Is there a point where we can actually communicate? Because, of course, if you're in very different contexts, you can't communicate your ideas with each other. There's no framework for understanding. So that's what I set out to do. I set out to try and understand what was going on, to see if there was common ground, and to see if we were maybe using similar sets of resources and even similar techniques, and what use those techniques might be to each party. So, you know, what could we bring to the table to help the Reconstructionist community? What access can we bring? What knowledge can we bring? What understanding can we bring? And equally, what are the Kemetic community doing that might help us understand Egypt from what we would call it is a phenomenological point of view? Phenomenology is, of course, your understanding of individuals as they experience religion, as they move through space. And that's something that's very closed off to us in Egyptology, because, of course, primarily Egyptian archaeology and Egyptology deal with fragments. You know, they deal with texts. I'm going to stop talking there just so I know that you're still there.
I am still here. I'm just eagerly absorbing it all as you're speaking.
So I was curious about this idea of, you know, Egypt being this concept and construct that could support a very wide variety of readings and interpretations. And what I wanted to do was really just grab a snapshot of the current cultural moment and see whether, you know, this Kemeticism that I was seeing and this, even the eclectic paganism, you know, what is this? Is this like a reclamation of Egypt from, you know, imperialist tendencies? Is it a continuation of imperialist tendencies? You know, these are all heritage issues. They're all heritage questions. Is it a reclamation of grassroots religion? You know, could it be looked at in that framework? And it certainly can, from what I've seen. And, you know, how does it kind of interact with these hierarchies? Because obviously there are hierarchies in the modern world, and we have to deal with those when we're dealing with any form of institution. And the internet, of course, is one of these tools that's come along and really helped us to a degree bypass these hierarchies. Now, what that's led to, of course, is a proliferation, this explosion of different groups, and it becomes very, very difficult to discern, well, you know, what is valuable and what is not. And I'm not saying that as an Egyptologist I can necessarily come in and decide that. That's not necessarily my place. But it does leave an awful lot of work should you want to interact with communities, because, you know, you have to remember that for me as an Egyptologist, these were unknown entities. I did not know at the beginning of my study what I was really going to encounter. I'd had experience with, you know, I was familiar with occult writings, I was familiar with pagan writings, I was familiar with esoterica and the history of those processes. I knew that, I understood that to a degree. But what I didn't understand really was what was happening in these groups, what resources were being used, you know, and how and why, and all these questions that are just huge questions once you start unpacking them, because it leads to... there's this danger of kind of value judgments every time you come across something that you're not familiar with, and you have to constantly reevaluate your own position to the work and the set of assumptions that you're bringing with you from what we would call a kind of hegemonic, I think you guys pronounce it hegemonic, discipline. Sorry, yeah, you were going to say.
I was going to take a momentary break.
let you have a sip of tea or water or something.
Yeah.
But I'm also tied into what you were just saying, why I wanted to take the break here, is I'm just going to play a bit of music. And this is by someone named Michael Atherton, and it's a CD called Ankh, the Sound of Ancient Egypt. And what he's done is he's simply used instruments and things that would have been found in ancient Egypt, as well as there are voices, but they're singing in ancient Egyptian. And so
singing
I thought
Egyptian. Okay.
Well, yes. So I just thought I would take the break here because I think it'll be very interesting, because to me this is just another way that a modern person is perhaps tapping into or reclaiming or at least envisioning what they see as that ancient Egyptian idea.
Okay.
So hopefully you will enjoy that.
Okay.
And there you have it.
Okay. Right. Thoughts and feelings, yeah?
Sure.
It's actually, what I find really interesting about that is some of the questions it raises about how we reconstruct Egypt. One of the things that I found particularly striking when I was looking at Kemetic communities was the number of similarities between our exercises. Now, obviously, there are ideological and conceptual similarities. That is to say that there's this idealized concept of academic objectivity, quote unquote, where we as academics are expected to enter into something not believing in the possibility of magic. We accept, we describe, and we catalogue, but we don't necessarily allow ourselves to internalize what's going on there. So that's one of the main differences between what's going on in academic Egyptology and Kemetology. But there's still this sense of reconstruction, that there is something there that we want, both parties want to put back together, want to try and understand. And one of those things, one of the crucial aspects of those things, is of course the language. And what strikes me when I hear something like that, or when I see, for instance, something like The Mummy, where they're speaking ancient Egyptian, is that, of course, these are, at best guess, pronunciation, because of the lack of vowel, the vowel sound in hieroglyphs, a lot of these things are our best guess as to what these things sounded like and how these words sounded. It's very interesting to hear someone singing ancient Egyptian, because it's something that, I mean, I've studied the language. I wouldn't feel confident in trying to pronounce it. A lot of the time, a lot of the times we use, for instance, when we describe the gods, or when we describe kings' names, are just convenient stop points, convenient handles. But what is interesting is the way that both Egyptology and Kemeticism respond to changes in the literature, because of course we're using a common set of resources a lot of the time, that being the Egyptian language and translations thereof. So for me, that's really a linchpin of one of the common areas between, you know, our quote-unquote kind of positivist, atheistic, anthropological exercise and the more spiritual, you know, living Egypt kind of Kemetic approach of reconstruction.
In doing the research for your thesis, I want to hear more generally about what different types of groups or people and practices you may have found or discovered in doing that. But I'm curious if you ever heard of or came across something called the Baladi. And that's a group that an author named Mustafa Galati says still exists in Egypt and continues to practice the ancient rituals and the ancient way.
I've come across different groups claiming those things under different names. I haven't come on air to out anyone, but I have come across these groups before. I've even, dare I say it, studied with one of these groups in my youth, who at least claim to be reconstructing, or not even reconstructing, continuing the practice. Now, what I've noticed with the group I have experience with, I don't have any direct experience with the group you're mentioning, was that a lot of the ideas seem to come from much later literature than what I would consider a quote-unquote kind of early original Egyptian. So there was a focus on the Assyrian triad, which of course is a much later development. There was a demonization of Set, which of course is a much later development. There were aspects of mythology that were clearly from Greek or Roman texts. I certainly wouldn't want to pass judgment on a group I've not encountered, but I have encountered groups claiming such things who, from what I can tell, reconstructing as much as anything else. I would look to, if you're looking for a continuation of ancient Egyptian literature, at least, and some of their mythology and some of their practices, you can actually find it in Egypt now, in a number of places. There's some pharaonic material in Sufism. Of course, the Coptic Church preserved a great deal of the language, and it surprises me that we don't look more towards the Coptic Church in the reconstruction of that language.
Mm-hmm.
Not that group, I'm sorry to say. So they may be, who knows, they could be the real deal. If they are, you know, I want to study them, get in touch.
Well, he's referring to them as the Baladi. That's more like, it's like calling a certain group of people the Bedouins or something.
Right.
It's not like, you know, just a particular group of people that call themselves that versus it's like the Gypsies. You know, it's this subset within the Egyptian people themselves.
It's not really something I have any familiarity with, but I'm guessing they're not online.
Probably not. So did you primarily focus on English-speaking, the English-speaking world, or did you also look at other places?
Yeah, I mean, with any PhD topic, or even with any, you know, when you're writing a book about something, you really do have to focus. The amount of material I had to exclude from my 100,000-word limit, I decided I needed to focus specifically on reconstruction, reconstructed Kemeticism. So that's, you know, a whole range of practices, and I wouldn't want to kind of be reductionist and call them all one thing. But what I did call it was a Kemetic continuum. And it was primarily English speaking because a lot of the practitioners are centered on Western groups, whether that be the House of Necha, or the Kemetic Temple of San Francisco or San Jose, or anything in between, and there were a number. So because of those centers are English speaking, there were people from various parts of Europe. I had one Kemetic who was actually from Egypt, but now living in London. So there were people from all over the world, but for the most part, of course, because of where I was based and because of how the work was structured, it was limited to the English-speaking world.
And did you find any particular intriguing similarities between different groups that may not even have a connection or communication with each other, and any particularly striking differences between groups and practices?
I don't think there's time on your radio show to go into that properly and do these guys justice. I would say that more similarities than difference, if I'm generalizing, more similarities than difference. There were certainly different ways of inferring and employing the terminology. So certain groups would use terminology in a different way. Usually one set of terminology is used to describe the other, and the other set of positive terminology is used to describe the self. But there's not really detail to go into every one of those terms, the time to go into detail there. But yes, there were some differences, obviously. You have, on this Kemetic continuum that was the framework that I ended up using to describe the various people and groups that I'd come across. There is an entire range from, the eclectic at one end, who is literally taking bits of various different cultures in the construction of their religious identity, to the slightly more, and this is not really an appropriate term, but conservative, for want of a convenient label, at the
orthodox,
other end.
Orthodox
is, well, even orthodox is a contentious term, to be honest with you. So,
well, yes.
you've got the slightly stricter reconstructionist at the other end, who really just wants to pull out what Egyptian material can be reconstructed and use that to the best of their ability. And, I'm certainly not going to pass any kind of value judgments on that right here. And I kind of go into some of the, should we say, structural problems and advantages of each of those approaches in the work. But it's a range. It's always a range. And this is the thing. Once you get into something, once you study something, ask any Egyptologist what their own field is like, and they'll tell you it's you can't easily quantify it. It's as different as every individual who practices it, and that's maybe the important thing to remember, is that we're all approaching similar things for our own reasons. Even the academics, each Kemetic has their own motivation, their own way of doing things, to a degree, who are unified under the banner of whatever movement speaks to them the most. So, I wouldn't really want to kind of fall into the trap of trying to pigeonhole any of those groups, though, because they are, of course, comprised of individuals.
Did you encounter any resistance, one, from the academic world when you were trying to present this as your possible thesis, and two, any pushback or resistance even from practitioners of Kemeticism when you asked about perhaps asking questions or studying them or, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I obviously approached this as explicitly as I could. That's to say, from a kind of ethical standpoint, I knew that I wasn't going to go into one of these worlds and pretend to join the group and, do that kind of underhand research. I feel that that's incredibly unethical. I think it's damaging to the community. I think it's damaging to academia and its reputation.
That would be like the researcher who pretends they're interested in it, joins the group, and then is just secretly getting the information and then writes with their own perspective on it rather than being upfront about it.
Exactly. And I mean, this is there's a whole body of literature devoted to this now, actually. And pagan research, researching paganism, part of it's a school of anthropology now, was incredibly useful in developing this approach. But it's all about your positionality. If you're honest with yourself and with your participants about your positionality, maybe at some point down the line, you do develop a rapport and you can speak more about your own personal opinions about these things. But at the outset, you have to, I think, anyway, if you're going to be ethical about it, you have to represent what people expect and try and do better than that expectation. So I came into it saying, yes, I'm an academic. I'm coming in from this, you know, this very reductive, deductive field of study to try and understand what's happening here. And of course, some people were resistant to that because they didn't want to be catalogued, because that's what they assumed, I suppose, that I was going to do, to just catalogue, describe, and reveal survival strategies as this kind of friendly enemy. Now, that has happened in anthropology before. There's a famous study by Tanya Lerman back in 1989 on witchcraft in London, Persuasions of the Witchcraft, I think it's called. And she upset a lot of people because even though she mentioned that she was doing this for research at the beginning, she was relieved. She describes herself as being relieved when they forget who she is and what she represents. Now, I didn't want to get myself into that situation. I wanted to be clear that this was all for research that was ultimately could be published and make sure that everyone was happy with whatever name they were using, you know, to represent their opinions. And, you know, I didn't want to come in and basically cause everyone issues. I just wanted to understand. But I did meet some resistance. There were some people on various boards who were not happy, who were very critical, who would literally jump on every post I put down, which made it very difficult in some places for me to get a conversation going because people would then be scared off. And as far as academia is concerned, I think in some ways I was lucky, and I think in some ways I had kind of mapped the road out because I'd already done a master's degree on Afrocentrism, Nile Valley Afrocentrism, trying to understand that and various processes that was involved in. And I think because I'd already taken the subject out of its comfortable bounds by facing that that particular challenge head on, luckily my department and my supervisors kind of had enough faith in me to say, okay, do it. Let's see what happens, you know.
And is the material in your thesis, is that the basis for your book that's coming out this year, Profane Egyptologists, or is that
that's
something?
Right.
It is.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah. What the book ended up being is kind of a play of three acts, so to speak. And you've got this exploration, you might call it an antagonistic exploration of the history of the development of Egyptology, of academic boundaries, of our self-conception. That's something that I really wanted to pull apart and say, why is it that we are not involving ourselves in these groups? What is the history? What is the premise? Is it just positivism? Is it something else? Is it something particular to Egyptology? And it turns out it's a mixture of those things, obviously. And in the second part, I look at the history of Esoterica and its involvement with Egyptology, and there's a lot more crossover than one might expect from both sides of the camp, if there are two sides, and even that's a kind of artificial binary position. And then the third part, of course, is the fieldwork itself, really, and trying to understand that fieldwork and represent people as much as I could in their own words, rather than mediating through my kind of inferences. I try to represent everyone in their own words so that it paints a picture of hopefully a range of the Kemetic community as they are, and tries to not only kind of fit that in with Egyptology and the contours of our discussion, but try and expand the boundaries of Egyptology to see, well, hang on, is there you know, common ground here, and can we make something productive out of that?
And do you know approximately what the expectation is for when the book will be published?
Oh, well, that's all down to me. The proposal has been accepted, and there's obviously no thesis is ready to just be a book. It's that simple. So I have some projects that I need to finish. I've got the documentary on the needle to finish. And once that's all done, we're hoping to shoot and get that finished in June. And once that is done, the conversion of the great work, I'll be able to devote more time to that, hopefully.
So we should expect it around July or August?
No, I would say more realistically, you're probably looking at the end of the year.
Yes.
Yeah.
And speaking of the documentary, Eye on the Needle, is that the one you're trying to raise funds for, or is that a separate project that you're also... Oh, it is.
Yes.
So can you say a little bit about what that documentary is about, and if you want, what kind of fundraising you're involved in or would like
to
support?
Yeah, that's great. Right, yeah. Basically, what we're doing is a documentary that looks at the current condition and the management strategy, that's to say the kind of conservation strategy of what we commonly call Cleopatra's Needle, which is the Egyptian obelisk of Thutmose III that sits on the bank of the Thames. It's an interesting artifact in that it was actually gifted to us. It's not something we plundered. And yet it's sitting outside. And this is, of course, problematic because it's a form of stone that doesn't have a lot of granite in it, which means it's slightly softer and more susceptible to the elements. We're aware of cleaning and quote-unquote conservation that was undertaken in 2005-06. And so we look in the documentary at the findings of that particular process, the management scheme for the preservation of the obelisk itself. We look at the history of it, the politics surrounding it, the ideas of conservation for it. We try to evaluate how under threat it is, and if so, try and work out a workable solution for that. And so the funding, the crowdfunding, will be on Sponsumi, and that's, well, all the information for that will be up on the eyeonthenedle.com, which will be coming up within the next 2 or 3 weeks or so. That there should be a funding page linked to that and a video explaining exactly what we're doing there. So, but yeah, we're very excited about it, and it seems to be garnering a fair amount of interest over here. So, and this is my kind of my foray into co-producing. I've had training and experience in hosting, but this is a new thing for me. So it's a whole different set of headaches to the ones I'm used to.
And any other projects that you have definitively in your sights at this point, or are those the two main ones that you're...
Those are the two main ones. The Eye on the Needle is a collaboration with Ed Scott Clark from Le Mode Vert Productions. He's to the film on environmental conservation, actually, called Plastic Shores. And also with Past Preservers, who are a kind of historical agency. So that's one of the main projects. And the book, I mean, between those two things and obviously working and trying to get papers out and trying to mark papers and teach, I'm pretty busy at the moment. So the idea of knocking out any other projects right now is not so appealing. Although I have done some consultancy on a feminist comic book actually recently, so that's one that's hang on.
Well,
yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's by Will Brooker, who's a fellow kind of academic and someone who helped me out a lot while I was doing my PhD. Called My So-Called Secret Identity. It's a comic book about a female superhero, and it's the idea of it is that it kind of goes against established trends of kind of hyper masculinity in pop culture. Fingers in lots of pies, you know?
Yeah. obviously this is the kind of topic that we could talk about for 3,000 or 4,000 years.
Easily.
If we really wanted to cover all of what it's about. But I, you know, want to thank you for taking the time to at least scratch a little bit of this surface. And I know personally, as well as I know other people, are very excited about, your thesis, your book, coming out in order to see what it is that you really uncovered in that research process about cometicism around the world. And it's, whether one wants to say it's revival or it's continuum of what was being done in ancient Egypt.
Yeah, all of those terms. It's great. It's great. I mean, I've had brilliant responses from the Kemetic community. I've had some fantastic dialogue with a great number of members of the Kemetic community, and I'm very, very grateful to all of their aid. And I'm going to do my absolute best to kind of, try and sneak out some copies from my publishers to a number of you. I would encourage anyone, to get in touch if they have questions, if they're interested in the status of the work and what's happening with that. Just get in touch, drop me an email, hit me up on Twitter @doc_Harrison. And, just hit me up. I always attempt to make time to talk to anyone who's involved in this study, who's interested to see what's happening, stuff like that.
And they can find you also at your website, drpaulharrison.com.
That's right, yep.
Is that the easiest way for them to contact you, or did you want to give out an email address?
Yeah, well, paul@drpaulharrison.com is my email, and you can find all of that from drpaulharrison.com, which is all the contact stuff is on there. Yeah, thank you for pimping that out for me.
And to finish each conversation every month, I always like to, one, ask you, the guest, what question you would like to ask the guest next month, without even knowing who it is or what the topic is, but any question that comes to mind that you would like to ask them. And then I'm also going to ask you the question that was asked by my guest last month, who is Sarah Astarte, who is a therapist and priestess. And her question, knowing that we were going to be doing this show around the time of spring equinox, for her, it's Ostara, which in the pagan community is the celebration of spring equinox. Mm-hmm. And her question with spring and growth and new life was, what is it that you would recommend that we work on in ourselves to cultivate or grow as we move into this new cycle of seasons and into the coming year?
Wow. How long you got?
Well, I have four seasons. Then we'll be back at spring equinox and need to ask a new question.
Right. Okay. Okay. So what can we work on in ourselves? On a personal level, on a group level, I think in the context of what we've been talking about, on a cultural level, and then a disciplinary level, I think kind of critical reevaluation, self-awareness. And that works, of course, on a personal level as well.
And I'm just going to repeat, because there was a little bit of a weirdness with Skype, that you said, just repeat those little aspects
said. Sure, yeah. Critical reevaluation, I think. That's to say that we need to kind of look at ourselves, our practices, our disciplines, whatever they be, even our lives, and just look back at those and think, okay, how can we make this better? How have we got to this point? How can we make this better? And I think maybe a little bit of optimism as well. We're coming out of this a fairly dark kind of negative egregore culturally, I think. It's reflected in our popular culture and a number of works that we've seen over the last kind of few decades. And I think it's time really for a little bit more optimism. Saying yes, kind of, it's a cliche, but saying yes brings opportunities, and just kind of being cynical and saying no closes them off. So maybe that's something we can all take with us as well.
Like focusing on how we create a new age rather than simply focusing on when is the apocalypse coming.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can frame it in that sense. It's, just thinking about building bridges, building a better future discipline, rather than worrying about the end of, this kind of crisis of being, cultural crisis, all of these crises, just think about, well, how can I make this better? How can I put something positive into my field, into what I do, into my life, or the people that I interact with professionally and personally? Just bring a bit of optimism to the table. I think it's past time. I think we need that.
And then, what question would you like to pose to my guest next month?
I tell you what, you kind of caught me on the back foot here. Okay, I'm gonna go with a slightly lighthearted one, actually, if that's all right.
That's fine. It's spring. We're feeling lighter. And
all right. Good. Good. I like that. Okay, and then in that case, my question for the next guest will be, if you could only eat one type of cuisine for the rest of your life, what cuisine would that be and why?
Wow. And how would you answer that question?
I think it would have to be Indian food.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, yeah. Yeah, good range. Good range.
Yeah.
Meat, vegetable, and rice. That works. Yeah.
Well, that will bring us to the conclusion of our conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having taken some time out to do this and Skyping in all the way from London.
Away from snowy, dark London, yeah.
Yes, but maintain that optimism even if it's snowy and dark. And we will continue to look forward to both the documentary as well as the publication of the book this year, and I will encourage people to keep up with the developments on that, either the release dates or the publication dates by visiting drpaulharrison.com, where I assume there will be updates.
Yeah, the documentary will be on eyeonthenedle.com. Oh, at the moment, it's the WordPress site, so it's eyeonthenedle, I think, .wordpress.com. But yeah, there'll be updates on my site and on Twitter at @doc_Harrison. And that's fantastic. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. And if there's any questions, I mean, with all of these kinds of things, you you try and frame things while you're talking, but sometimes you skip over things or there's misinterpretation. So if anyone's got any further questions to this, you know, do hit me up with an email. I'll try and, you know, we'll try and get that on a discussion forum somewhere.
All right. Great. Well, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
And
cheers.
Enjoy the rest of the day.
You too. Yeah, in better weather.
Yes. Well, fortunately, I have that, so... Good luck to you with that.
Thank you. Cheers.
Bye. And that was Dr. Paul Harrison, Egyptologist. And I would encourage you to check out more about him and the work he's doing at drpaulharrison.com. Stay tuned, because coming up in just a moment, we'll have our magical moment, and it's going to be a little bit spring-related, something fairly simple to do but can be quite effective, and something that isn't just necessarily a one-time thing, but something that you can continue to do throughout the year to both honor and connect with and live in harmony with the cycle of the seasons. So stay tuned for that, and we will be right back in just a minute.
We've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows. Be sure to check out The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. More than just a call-in show, Heisey and Charlie will bring a new and unusual perspective to the power and capacities of the Tarot. Also join us for A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella. On the first and third Tuesdays each month at 8 p.m., John will bring together leaders and explorers in neo-shamanism. Practical and practiced, his guests are not just doing shamanism, they're living it. And don't miss What's Your Prescription for Balance with Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday evening of each month. They'll inspire you with the leading trends and best practices of holistic living, alternative medicine, and life coaching. This vibrant duo and their amazing guests will help you energize and balance your life from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows LIVE Presents for these new shows and our original Sunday morning Firefly Willows LIVE anchor shows.
And I will encourage you and invite you and look forward to having you listen in to the show I co-host with Charlie Harrington this coming Tuesday at 8 o'clock Pacific time, The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist. And the magical moment that I wanted to offer to you was actually inspired by a teaching that was transmitted to me. I was at a conference recently called Pantheacon, which is a four-day pagan conference with a variety of presentations, workshops, rituals, etc. And there was approximately 2,500 people there, and it happens every year in February. And I attended a ritual that actually was to honor Mercury, Hermes, and Thoth, or Jehudi. And those are kind of conflated to be seen as one god. Personally, I see them as three separate gods, but they all have similar qualities. In that they have to do with communication, wisdom, divination. There's some trickster aspects. Of course, for me, being Kemetic, my particular affinity was for Thoth or Jehudi, which is the Egyptian name. And I received a teaching from him during that ritual, and I wanted to share it here with you. And I'm just going to say it in the way that it came to me, and then I will talk to you about it. And the teaching was, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was, is, and ever shall be you, meaning Jehudi. Words said and thoughts expressed become reality manifest. Jehudi, grant us the knowledge to know what we are saying and the thoughts we are expressing that manifest the reality we deserve. Jehudi, bless us with the will and with the wisdom to know and say the words and express the thoughts that may manifest the reality we desire. And if you really, so this really touches on an ancient Egyptian way of approaching, the universe, magic and that kind of thing, in the sense that anything that is expressed or given form, whether in word, in writing, hieroglyph, or letters that we might use, or expressing a thought out loud, is what infuses it with the energy to become manifest and to become real. So we have to look at the words we use on a regular basis, the way that we talk about ourselves or others or a situation or a thing. That is what creates the reality around that. If we're constantly using words that are angry or negative, then we cannot be surprised that we live in a reality where we feel surrounded by angry people, people that are less pleasant to be around, difficult or challenging or conflicted situations. And then we want to look at how can we start to speak differently in order to manifest a different reality that we desire rather than getting what it is that we deserve because of what we're using without thinking about what we're saying or expressing. So one thing I wanted to offer in this magical moment was something that you can do now and throughout the year to help stimulate a different or a new or a more conscientious way of communicating and using words so that we are doing so in order to bring about the reality we want and what we want to live within rather than feeling as if we're being subjected to a reality that we deserve or that we don't want but not recognizing how we're actually creating that. So this is something that you can very simply use. I would suggest a light blue or a blue candle because that corresponds to the throat chakra, and blue tends to stimulate and encourage and support communication and truth. And communication is both about speaking and listening. And if you wanted, you could also use a stone in conjunction with this. That way you would have something to carry around that you're energizing each time. And on the one hand, with that blue, you could think of any blue stone as having a general correlation to the throat chakra. But, you know, specific ones that I might suggest that you could use would be blue kyanite, lapis lazuli, aquamarine, sodalite, sapphire. Sapphire is actually really good for communicating with the higher self, for hearing that intuition and who we need to be and what is in our highest interest. So you would simply place the candle in a space that you're going to set aside for this. You can put the stone in front of it. If you had a particular intention, you could write or carve into the candle what that intention is, or you could write it on a piece of paper and set it underneath the candle. Of course, you want to put a little something between the candle and the paper so it doesn't catch on fire. That might be good. And then what you want to do is perhaps on the new moon, which is tomorrow, a great time to do this. New moons are good for thinking about what you want to start or what you would like to initiate. Doing it on the full moons, which is how you can see things in their full light. How am I expressing myself? What am I saying? What am I doing that is creating my reality? And then what do I need to start changing or releasing or eliminating in order to have the reality I desire rather than deserve? And you might also do it on the spring equinox as kind of the start of a new cycle or new seasonal aspect of communication and thought. And you would simply light the candle and state your intention. And it might be as simple as, may I have the words to say and say them in a way that creates the reality that I desire. You might also say something like, may I be shown how I might be speaking or expressing myself that is creating a reality I deserve but don't want. And then you can carry that stone around with you to help support you, as well as every time you feel it in your pocket, for example, it will remind you, oh, what words am I using? What do I need to be saying? Or what am I not saying? Or what am I not hearing or listening to that I need? So that would be our magical moment. And that would be my suggestion for something you might consider doing. Thank you very much for listening. And I encourage you to check out Amethyst Oracle on this coming Tuesday, 8 o'clock Pacific time. Next Sunday will be John Carosella's show, Convergence, and that'll be at 10:30 on Sunday morning. All right. Thank you. Enjoy and have an amazing spring equinox.
I'm John Carosella, host of A Shamanic Life and Convergence on Firefly Willows LIVE. I'd like to invite you to a new monthly study series starting in April, Taking Up the Runes, Living Amidst Their Power. We live in an American-dominated world with a worldview we inherited from the British, who were, in turn, powerfully shaped by the Norse. And the power of the Norse is the power of the runes. I invite you to join me in a 12-month program to intimately study the runes. Understanding the runes, I believe, will illuminate the deeply hidden power structures and assumptions that form our contemporary world. In these times of radical change, I believe understanding the runes is essential to the successful and peaceful transformation of our world. Join me. Learn more by sending an email to me at jc@theshamanist.com. More information will be available online shortly, but for the moment, indicate your interest via email. Our plan is to meet once a month for a Sunday afternoon and understand these archetypal powers. Make no mistake, we are surrounded by them. Seeing them clearly will help us wisely incorporate them as allies instead of being at their mercy. If you're interested in learning more, email me at jc@theshamanist.com.
Thank you for joining us on today's episode of Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Carosella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, with Heisey Lutmers and Charlie Harrington, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.